The views and opinions of the host, guests, and callers of Radio Free ARFCOM do not necessarily reflect those of AR15.com, BBS Radio, or their advertisers. When any techniques, skills, or theories are presented, they reflect the practices and opinions of the individual presenting them, but not necessarily those of Radio Free ARFCOM, AR15.com, or BBS Radio. In all circumstances, Radio Free ARFCOM, AR15.com, and BBS Radio expressly disclaim any liability that may result in the use or misuse of any information featured in this program.
Transmission begins.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Here we go.
Let's go.
Stuff you've heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love the sting of battle.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty, or give me death.
Radio Free ARFCOM starts now.
Yes, Radio Free ARFCOM starts right now. I am your host, John Gold. The show brought to you by the home of the Black Rifle, AR15.com, the greatest website on the entire interweb. I want to wish everybody a happy holiday last week. I hope you had a great Memorial Day. I had a great weekend. Hope you took some time to sit down and reflect on what Memorial Day really means. Give a thought and a prayer for the troops we have in the field now, a prayer of thanks for those who have come before us, made the ultimate sacrifice for our freedoms here in the greatest republic the world has ever seen, the United States of America. As usual, we get the show started off with ARFCOM superstar Joe DeBurgolis. Joe, how are you today?
Great, John. How you doing, my friend?
Doing fantastic today, fantastic. Now, before we get into the couple of news stories that I wanted to discuss with you. I understand that there is he a Marine up in New York there that you guys have been working with?
Yes, Corporal Aaron Howell is a Marine that unfortunately in actions of combat by a mortar round lost the use of his legs. He's from the Potsdam, New York area. And if people go to the New York hometown forum under the thread title, Fire Mission, A Matter of Honor, we are raising money on his behalf, and basically any donation, large or small, the donation goes straight to the church where his parents worship, Norfolk Wesleyan Church. The address is on the thread. And in return for that, if you just post that you gave, there's a variety of appreciation items there, and the winner takes all. So if people would be so kind as to help out this Marine up in New York, would be greatly appreciated, and it's just something that we should do.
Yeah, it sounds like a really good cause. You always have a way of finding your way towards these really good causes. I don't know how you do it, but it sounds like a really good idea. Anybody wants to contribute a lot or a little, whatever you can, to this guy, another one of our great warriors who made a really big sacrifice for us, and we've got nothing but love for him. And apparently there's some pretty decent stuff you guys are giving away.
Well, it's all National Rifle Association swag, variety of hats. There's water bottles and variety of other good items on there. We've got some books from Wayne LaPierre and seals, DVDs, and a whole bunch of other good stuff. And I'm sure we'll be adding more. But it's a winner-take-all. It's more of an appreciation type of thing for helping out the family. We've got
sure.
a tremendous amount of response, John, from it. Our commers are traditionally very charitable, and obviously they want to help out our fallen and wounded military members. So it's something that's been very well received. I'm getting a tremendous amount of feedback through IMs and telephone calls. There'll be more to come, too. We got some great people we're working with right now on some other objectives to help out Corporal Howell. So we'll be making announcements in the future on that as well.
Okay, sounds good. It sounds really good. Now, let's dip into the news a little bit. There were a couple of news stories that I read over the last week and a half or so, and t- two of them really sprang out, leapt out to me, and I wanted to discuss them with you. One of them was a senator. I don't know if I'm pronounced this correctly. Inhofe. Senator Inhofe is introducing some legislation to help protect our soldiers, our active duty soldiers, with their Second Amendment protections. I guess there are some really weird and individual unique laws based on what base you are stationed at and what your rules and regulations for firearm possession are?
Most certainly. We've been tracking this situation for a couple of years now because the garrison commanders, basically at all the military installations, the member in charge, can dictate how their active members need to or can store, possess, personally owned firearms. Some are very good, and some are very bad. Collectively, we've sat there on a case-to-case basis and dealt with the issue. The one mentioned most prominently is the case in Fort Riley, Kansas, where the base commander there came out with these egregious type of rules stating that if you live off base, you have to register your firearms. And you can't have them in the state of Kansas with you. It's very, very limited, very, very restrictive, draconian at best. And that was the one kind of perk our interest even further at the NRA. Now, NRA, Institute for Legislative Action, like I said, has been tracking this for a couple of years. We're right on top of it. And a good senator came forward and dropping legislation to protect the Second Amendment rights of our military and that of the Department of Defense civilian personnel. Let's not forget what happened down at Fort Hood.
Absolutely.
When a military member came in and did what he did. That was a terrorist attack, although the current administration does not want to call it such, but that's what it was. And to disarm our serving members and our civilian counterparts on these bases is ridiculous, especially when they're trained and they understand and everything's secured and checked and what have you. So this legislation was dropped to basically codify or standardize what's going on at our military bases around the country. And it will basically tell the Sec Defense that he will set policy that will prohibit or issue any requirement relating to or the collection of a record of, other than lawful acquisition, possession, ownership, carrying, or other privately owned firearm, ammunition, and the like. And it goes on and on, and you can go on the website to see exactly the language of the bill. But what it's going to do is restore the basic rights of anybody who's a resident or a citizen, basically, I'm sorry, a citizen of this country. So it's kind of, it's diverse. We're fighting right now legislatively. Heller and Supreme Court, obviously, they came in our favor. We're waiting for the verdict with Chicago, McDonald. And now we have to worry, our servicemen and women have to go to their bases and give up the rights of which they're fighting to protect. So it's kind of this diverse type of mentality going on. And it's amazing that this has been going on. It came to a head now, and I don't know if it's because of the policies of this current administration or just this happened to be what people believe it should be happening at this time. It's wrong.
Yeah.
It really is.
I was taking a look at the Fort Riley rules, and it's just unbelievable. I mean, you have to actually register the firearms owned by any family members living in the state.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's just something you're looking at going, are you kidding me? So obviously what's happening is the serving member is not saying, so he or she would technically be in violation, and they are making the complaint to us. The National Rifle Association obviously has a natural affinity with members of the military.
Absolutely.
Our membership is made up of quite a great deal of them. So we're getting phone calls, what have you. We're sending out lawyers, and we're doing legal briefs and what have you. It's ridiculous. And every once in a while, you see some of these types of restrictions come from a civilian government or elected officials, that kind of thing, that would, not on a military basis. So when we saw that, obviously, we're right on top of it. We're monitoring the situation. We're going forward. I can't really give you our strategy right now, but the good senator was this was the first attack at restoring the rights on the bases and forts and camps and military installations throughout the country.
Yeah, and I think it's a great piece of legislation he's putting through. If you live in Oklahoma, send Senator Jim Inhofe a little thank you note telling him you support what he's doing for our troops, protecting their right to bear arms here in the United States when they're stationed here. Now, you mentioned McDonald's Chicago. Do we even have an idea when we're going to get a ruling on that? It should be any time now, shouldn't it?
Any time. We were told possibly in the month of May. I think due to the pending announcement, or not the announcement, but the pending situation, what's happening with the president's nominee to replace the retiring justice, that may have delayed things just a tad. It should be any day now.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that one. I think there's no doubt they're going to rule in our favor, and that will be another great victory. Now, another story that caught my eye here, and this has been going around ARFCOM for a little while, but I'm not sure I understand everything that's going on with this. It's the BATF-E, you know, they got the explosives on there now. But the ATF has reversed a policy that they've had in place now for 40-something years regarding temporary transfers for non-employee business reasons.
Yeah, this one leaves me scratching my head, too. Basically, the policy previous to this edict was, and it was issued right after 1969 or 68 when we had the Gun Control Act, which allowed a manufacturer to transport or ship to gun writers, various stuff, a testing institution, or what have you, without the use of a typical FFL transfer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, lo and behold, ATF felt in the best interest, again, we don't know where that's coming from right now, that they would have to go through the normal chain of a private transaction, which would mean going through the completion of a form 4473 in an extra background check each time. And we don't know why, and they can't point to one reason, one case or one incident, when one of these firearms previous in the old policy was ever lost or used inappropriately or used in the furtherance or commission of a crime. So this whole development is something where why, especially since 69, it worked fine through different administrations. Why all of a sudden is it changed now?
Yeah, it boggles the mind. I don't understand it.
You know, and we're looking at this, and anybody who follows the NRA activism thread, I keep telling people to sit there and prepare and get ready and write and get engaged in the process. Trying to connect the dots here as to why ATF will come out. And the agents in ATF, let me tell you something, they do a fantastic job. They really, really do. They're out there, they're fighting, they do a variety of investigations, they're top-notch professionals. Inspectors are a little different, and when this comes out with their, policy, and this is coming from the policy, this is a governmental-driven or a type of policy. This isn't the rank-and-file members bringing this forth. So we're monitoring it, we're looking at it. The good folks down at ILA are engaged in the process, and I'm sure we'll have some announcements in the near future as to what's going to happen, what our course of action is going to be.
And it's interesting because reading on NRAILA.org, they suggested that this might have broader impact. I know a lot of people are listening, and they're like, well, I'm not a gun writer, and I don't do a lot of testing or anything, so it's not going to affect me. But it could have an effect on ranges that rent weapons out to people. To where you might have to fill out a 4473 just to rent a gun at a range.
Exactly. And that's why I'm saying we're kind of monitoring, putting our finger on the pulse and see where this is going to go. Because in states that allow that, it's great that when you vacation to go, I know when I go to Nevada, I rent firearms, or I go to Florida, I can do the same thing. Arizona, you can do it. A couple states that come to mind. Where you go in, you rent, you show what you have to show, and you're all set. Well, if we have to go through this in background checks, so we don't know if it's a backdoor way for them to prohibit or put these type of firearms establishments out of close their doors or out of business or what it is. So that's why we're really, if this came to light, we're going to be looking at it, and we want to make sure we shut down every avenue they will have that will be injurious to our rights and to the firearms industry and to our friends who run the firing ranges and the shooting ranges and all that kind of good stuff.
Now, I know we don't know exactly who this came from, but you read the headlines and it says a recent ruling, and you think that maybe some judges had something to do with it. But this is simply the ATF acting on their own accord, just changing the rules halfway through the game, basically.
Well, yeah, right. That's what I'm saying. It comes from policymakers. It's coming from a source within ATF or higher saying that we're going to do this. Why all of a sudden would you, since 69? If you're going to do it after the 68 Gun Control Act, you would think passing the legislation was pretty much restrictive a lot of things. And, you know, the ruling was after 69, the year thereafter, that this is the correct and proper way. When you can't show or articulate or bring to light one violation of that policy from 69, why all of a sudden in 2010 is it so important to do so? You know, normally when these policies are changed or there's a anti-gun movement, they usually focus on some type of horrific incident that happened.
Right.
Point to the Columbines and Littletons and that kind of thing when these things happen. They don't do it. There was no type of reason for this. So it had come from the policymakers. And we'll get to the bottom of it, John. We'll report back in the coming days and weeks. And knowing Chris Cox and his people over there, they're working overtime on it, and we'll put some roadblocks in the whole thing.
I have absolute faith that I know you guys will. I know the NRA will step in and see what they can do. This is ATF is, they're getting a little big for their britches. They always kind of have been, but this is just another example of you get too much government, it gets too big, and then you start infringing on people's rights in the most inane and just kind of asinine type of ways.
We'll get to the bottom. We'll get that. There's a lot of good folks that work there. It's just one of those type of things. It's a regulatory type of situation where it touches us particularly because of our love for firearms.
Absolutely.
And our love of freedoms. We'll get to it. We'll get them going.
Well, as always, I want to thank you for taking some time out of your busy schedule. You always give us a good 15, 20 minutes, and I appreciate everything you do for not only us here at AR15.com, but for gun owners all over the country, Joe.
Thanks, John. Have a great show.
Thank you. That was Joe DeBurglis, AR15.com superstar NRA board member. As I always remind everyone, he was the first endorsed candidate from AR15.com. Now we have several on the NRA board. Next year, hopefully, we'll have even more than that. Coming up on today's show, just want to give you guys a heads up what we have coming on. I have Micah Clark coming on next from Camp Patriot. There are some wounded veterans that are participating in the Pony Express Memorial Ride next week, and they're going to come through actually right here in Salt Lake City, Utah. They're going to come through. I'm going to go out and cover that, get some good live audio for you guys, and put together a story, bring it back on the show next week. He's going to come on here in just a couple of minutes and talk about that. And then after that, we have Fairfall 308. His name is Fernando. I'm sure you guys know who he is. He lived through all the mess and the nightmare that was Argentina earlier this decade when they had basically total societal collapse, rampant inflation, currency devaluation. A lot of the things that we're worried about could possibly happen here in the United States. And he's going to – we have a good maybe 35-minute interview with him of him just giving us the lowdown on what happened and how he got through it and some of the tips and strategies that he used to make it a little easier to get through. And then after that, we have two of the superstars from the Noveski shooting team. Now, these guys are just tearing things up in the three-gun world right now, man. They're just going through and just producing results at basically every event they go to. They're going to come on, talk a little three-gun with us, talk about what it's like to be on the Noveski shooting team, and give away some free Noveski little stickers and T-shirts for anybody who wants to call in and ask them a question. You get on the air, and we will send you a Noveski T-shirt sticker package. That's coming up in the second hour. Right now, just waiting to get Micah Clark online. I wanted to talk a little bit. I don't know how many of you guys have paid attention to the story that happened in the United Kingdom over the last week. There was a guy, and he was your typical, he was a quiet neighbor and all that. And as everyone knows, the gun laws in the United Kingdom are some of the toughest in the world. It's very hard to possess a gun over there. It's very hard. I don't even think you can have a magazine-fed weapon that holds more than two rounds, I believe, is how the law is written over there. Now, someone could correct me if I'm wrong on that. They've got these just draconian, restrictive gun laws, and somehow they had a massive shooting. This guy went around, killed 12 people last week. You know, your typical, oh, he was just a quiet neighbor. You know, he didn't have any problems with him before. He passed all the background checks, the psychological evaluation, the criminal background check to be able to possess guns, and yet still another episode of more gun laws does nothing but make it easier and make a killing zone, and just all these gun-free zones are just victim zones. It's just amazing. The people that he shot, you know, people out on bike rides and exercising and salesmen passing through, and none of these people even had a chance with this guy going around. It's just another example of what happens when you get too many gun laws. We've got Micah Clark online with us now. He's on with Jack Rhodes. Are you guys there?
We're here.
Yes.
Oh, outstanding. Good to hear from you guys. Micah, I know you're doing some great work out there at Camp Patriot. We had you on here a couple of months ago. Have you had any big events here in the last couple of months?
Let's see. We had our training event down in Arizona for getting ready for our climb in July on Mount Rainier. We're excited about getting ready to go with Jack down here to Utah for the Pony Express ride. So as soon as we're done with that, we'll be gearing up for the climb again.
So the Mount Rainier climb is next month?
July.
Okay, and that's the big one. Right. Yeah, that sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. Now, Jack, it's nice to meet you. Mike has said a great deal of good things about you. And why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about the Pony Express. Is it the Memorial Ride? Is that what they call it?
Well, yes. We have an organization called the National Pony Express Association, and every year we do a re-ride of the mail between Missouri, St. Joe, Missouri, and Sacramento, California. And we have probably about 580 people involved across the seven states. And we do it within 10 days and nights. We take them a Chia saddle. Just stop me if I'm talking about too much.
No,
we take them a Chia saddle just like they had before, a piece of leather and four pockets, and throw it over the saddle. And you take, every member gets a 2-mile ride, whether he's loping along or running, meet the next guy, throw it on his horse, then you can drive forward and get another 2 miles, probably 3 or 4 2-mile runs. I'm in the Utah division. I'm one of the trail bosses, and I'm responsible to get it across the state of Utah. And that's what we do. If you want to talk a little bit about the history of the Pony Express, the dates and everything, I can tell you about that.
I would like to talk a little bit about the history in a moment here. Now, I want to talk a little bit about how it works now. You guys actually re-ride the entire route?
We do. I'm in the Utah division, for example. And each state has their own division. But about this time every year, middle of June, when there's a moonlight or a full moon, we'll go ahead and retrace the route as close as possible, and there's a lot of close roads close to where the Pony Express originally ran, along with some of the stage route out this way. And we do it. We're post office carriers. I mean, you could send a $5 letter across the whole way, and it'll get canceled on the way out, or when it arrives, and send it to anybody. That's a lot of fun way to keep the history alive.
Yeah, that's really cool. Now, tell us a little bit about the history. I know a bit about the Pony Express, but for those of our listeners that don't know everything about it, why don't you give us a brief overview of it?
Well, back in the 1860s, it took quite a while while to get information back to the West Coast and even out into the Salt Lake area, especially the people out San Francisco area, the coal miners, people that were moving into that area. And if you send a piece of mail by boat down around the bottom of South America, you know, it's like a month and a half. Well, or across the States, and a lot of it got lost at that. And it just wasn't arriving fast. What was happening? You remember in 1850, at the inauguration of President Lincoln and other things going on, people wanted to hear stuff faster, so someone came up with some enterprising men came up with the idea of doing it by horseback. And they spent a lot of money at it. It worked out pretty darn good. It got to going really well. And then 18 months after they started it, of course, the telegraph finished, and it virtually stopped. And they had trouble with, you know, with the weather, with the environment, and of course, the Indians were quite curious and used to give them a hard time in certain areas. But each rider back then would ride 10 or 15 miles on one horse, then they'd have stations along the way. There'd be a station master. He would keep some fresh horses. He'd come into the station, jump off one horse, throw the bag on another, and he'd go supposedly for around 50 miles. Some of them even went further than 50 miles in a single run using different horses. And that's the way they did it. They flip-flop back and forth, and they would run. They would, one would start from California, the other from St. Joe, Missouri, where the train ended there at the Missouri River at that time, and out through the west they would go. Cost $5 to send one little thin oil skin piece of paper. If that's all they would allow you to do, you'd have so much mail to throw on those pouches, and people were just as happy as heck to get information of what was going on back east or out west.
Yeah, it's a great piece of American history, especially history of the West, and it's a testament to good old-fashioned American know-how and ingenuity to, you see a problem, well, let's figure out a way to solve it. And that was just an interesting way to solve it.
You know, troubles with the Indians. They had their little Colt pistols, Navy Colt pistols, 44s, 45s, that they were issued. And my great-great-grandfather, his name was Howard Egan, was living in out west of Salt Lake at Ibapah on the border of Nevada, and had a ranch out there. And they used him as a superintendent from Salt Lake for the route between Salt Lake and Roberts Creek, Nevada, southeastern Nevada.
Oh, okay. So
he and his boys, one of which was my great-grandfather, were real good with trucking things between Salt Lake and San Francisco. In fact, he helped to establish one of the routes out there. So that's kind of in my blood, and that's why I'm with it. And a lot of people have joined us. This year is the 150th anniversary, and we've got people that are ecstatic about coming and being with us, and we are, and I personally, as a veteran, I'm very thrilled to work with Mike and get some of these disabled veterans out and host them on this. It's Mike is a great guy of all the things he does, and I just couldn't let it pass to not invite some of them and be along in this this great event.
Yeah, Mike, enough can't be said about what you do. You do more with less, I think, than any other veterans organization out there. You really, the stuff you do, and I know the type of budget that you have to run on, it's just amazing that you can get as much done as you do. Why don't you talk a little bit? You're going to have a couple of guys come out, some wounded veterans come out, and they're going to actually participate in the ride?
Correct. I've got, you know, when Jack and I became friends a couple of years ago, and he was a former helicopter pilot in Vietnam, and I just came across the subject that he was getting ready for the Pony Express ride, and I thought, wow, what a neat adventure to possibly get some guys involved in. And I instrumentally really wanted to get a couple of Green Berets. I know in Afghanistan, on the onset, these guys were put on horseback. And so you look at a 21st century war being fought on horseback and F-18s, it's kind of a neat way to possibly get some guys out of 5th Group and some of the other groups there to participate. And so we're fortunate to have a guy named Gil, who was in the 5th Group that helped secure. He was on the ODA team that secured Karzai when he was president-elect. And while they were protecting him and taking on the Taliban, he was case, the appointed president, first president of Afghanistan, and Gil was injured by a JDAM, a joint munition, basically a big bomb, and injured him, and we were able to, he's recovering pretty good and does some triathlons and things, but he's got some hearing and seeing things going on with him, and he was first guy I asked to be on the ride, and he's pumped up to go, and then I got a 7th group Green Beret, so we've got some pretty excited Special Forces guys getting ready to get back on horseback and participate in this event.
Yeah, this is going to be a really cool event. I'm excited for next weekend. Now, before we get any further, Jack, is there a website for your organization?
Yes, XP, that's for Express, xphomestation.com.
xphomestation.com. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to go check it out right here while I got you guys online. Okay, Pony Express Home Station. Now, the event is actually pretty big. It's not just we just recreate the ride. There's actually going to be like a parade here in Salt Lake next Monday up at Pioneer Village, and there's going to be some other side events going on with the ride, correct?
Right. Starting off, we're bringing the mail in from Nevada. Let's see, on Sunday night. No, wait a minute. Is it Saturday night, I guess? Oh, Sunday night. And on the, is that the 13th? Gosh, I'm mixed up. I'm clear down here.
14th. I think the 14th, Jack.
Okay. And it will come into it will come from Ibapah into Calio. And the Calio is a little community way out west of Salt Lake. And, boy, they're going to be a hoopla out there. They're inviting a lot of people in. And then it will come in it'll come into Simpson Springs, which everybody knows about. It's a nice area. And the mail will be turned over to another group. And they'll have quite a, I think the counties or the JCs in Tula are putting on quite a feed out there. Anybody wants to come by? Then we're going to go a little further to Eagle or Lookout Mountain and camp overnight. We're going a little slower this year. It doesn't move along this year. We're just having a couple events in each state. And in the morning of the Monday morning, then it'll make its way over to Fairfield. Some people have been out to Fairfield, the old Stagecoach station and Pony Express station. And there'll be some presentation there. To Eagle Mountain for a short presentation, on into Sandy City on State Street, and Sandy City Center. There'll be quite a celebration and some, I can't tell you all that's going on there, but it'd be good to be over there in the afternoon. And then the mail makes its way on up to this is the place, Pioneer Park, in Salt Lake. By about, 4 o'clock, 5, there should be a nice celebration up there. And up there, we have a bigger-than-life monuments, or brass monuments of Pony Express riders, and then a cabin we built for the 2002 Olympics we placed over there. It's to typify a Pony Express station on the desert. So right. Come along and watch people ride and be part of these events and really learn a lot about the Pony Express.
Yeah, it's just a really cool thing. I guess, I've actually been up to this is the place State Park and seen the statue and that you have up there. It's really cool. But I guess today was actually the day that the Pony Express ride started and the mail actually left Sacramento, California today, right?
I think it was today, yes. I'm on doing something down in Texas today, so I didn't follow what hour it left. But, gosh, we've got ham radio operators following along. You can actually, there'll be, I think if you look at that website, xphomestation.com, they'll refer you to a lot of things that are going on and give you a pretty good outline.
Yeah, I've been taking a peek at the website. I've been taking a peek at the website while I've had you guys on. It's really cool. They've got all the information you want there. If you're in the Utah area in the next week or so, or anywhere along the Pioneer Express routes, check out the website, xphomestation.com. See if you can come and just kind of be a participate as a spectator, come and be there for one of the events. I guess they have food at some of the events, some really good food, and you'll get to know a little bit more about our history and culture. That's all the time I have for you guys this week, but next week I'm going to meet Micah when he gets in town, and I'll come out with you guys, with both of you, Jack and Micah, and I'll interview the soldiers that are going on the ride and get their view and their perspective from it, some of their history. It's going to be a really cool story to put together.
Well, excellent.
Thanks
yeah,
for having
John,
me,
sure
and I look forward to seeing you.
I look forward to meeting both of you. And I want to thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, before I let you go, I want to thank both of you for your service to our country. I know you guys are both veterans, and we really appreciate our veterans here on Radio Free ARFCOM.
That means a lot. Thank you.
Yeah, we appreciate it, John, and all the listeners out there. We love you, gun-toting, Bible-clutching Americans, so keep it up.
Absolutely. That was Micah Clark from Camp Patriot, Jack Rhodes from the Pony Express Memorial Ride that they do, the National Pony Express Association. It's a really cool program that they do, and it's awesome that Micah and Camp Patriot could get involved and get some of our wounded warriors over there to participate in it. Just really cool. I like stories like that, and it's going to be fun. I'm going to go out, and I'll get some audio and get some interviews and get some horse sounds and the whole nine, put together a nice story for all the Radio Free ARFCOM listeners next week. Right now we're going to go into my interview with Fairfowl. His name's Fernando. His screen name on AR15.com is Fairfowl308. He's got videos on YouTube. He's got his own blog. Just well-written, well-accomplished guy. Now, when I did the interview with him, he was in Texas last week. He was only here for a couple days, and I only had one chance to do the interview. The audio on the interview is not perfect. There's a little bit of feedback and a little bit of echo, but the interview is so good, I have to play it anyway. So enjoy this sit-down with Fairfowl, everyone, Fairfowl 308. We're on right now with one of ARFCOM's more legendary members. This is a guy who he himself has actually lived through the spit hitting the fan. That's right. We're going to talk to Fairfowl 308. You guys know him as Fairfowl. He's written an awful lot about living through the spit hitting the fan in Argentina, where they had, earlier this decade, some serious economic and societal collapse. He's going to talk about living through that, some of the strategies and techniques, tactics that he used, and some of the advice that he has for us, people that are preparing for just that sort of thing here in the United States. His real name is Fernando. I'm going to call him Fernando. How are you today, Fernando?
Doing fine, thanks.
I understand you are here in the States, actually. That's what allowed us to actually get this interview in, correct?
Yeah, I'm in Fort Worth and having a good time here in Texas.
Do you come here often?
Well, it's my first time here in Texas. I traveled a lot to USA. I lived in Boston when I was little, when I was 3 years old, for three years. And after that, we went back to Argentina, but we usually kept coming to USA to travel and on a holiday.
Oh, cool. All right. So you're familiar with the United States, but you did grow up in Argentina.
Yeah.
Now, when did the people of Argentina first notice that things were starting to go downhill and there might be some serious problems there?
Well, it actually caught most people by surprise. I mean, by mid-2001, we started noticing that things weren't getting any better, and there was already talk and speculation of things actually getting much worse. But I think, if you ask me, I think no one realized what was going to happen until the day they defaulted on our debt and our currency lost 66% of its value almost overnight. So I'd say that most people, the great majority, they just never expected it.
Oh, wow.
Those that were into the know-how and those that were in the economy and were in the banking world, they may have a better idea. And that's where my family got a bit of the rumor. So that's when we started checking what happened. When we finally decided to go to the bank where my sister and I had a small account, $1,000. We went to the BBWA, the French bank, and asked to close our account. And they said that they didn't have $1,000 in their bank. So that's when things got very suspicious.
Yeah. So was this in 2002, actually, or was this still in 2001?
This was in December 2001.
Okay, so right before the big default happened, you guys kind of had a heads up, and were you able to get any money from the bank at all?
Yeah, that same day when they told us that they didn't have $1,000 in the bank, we went to the main branch, closed the account. My mother closed her account and we managed to save the money we had there.
Oh, wow. You guys got really lucky. That's a preparedness meeting opportunity right there.
Yes, yes. And so it's also a matter of luck, because 1 or 2 days later, it would have been too late. There's people
right.
that paid their debt in dollars the day before it actually devaluated, and it was no longer pegged to the peso one-on-one. So they ended up losing a fortune just because they paid their debts as they were supposed to. Some people lost money, some people made it, and those are the things that happen when things change that way.
Once that happened, you guys had to have known bad things were on the way. Once you went to the bank, they didn't have the money, you had to go to the main branch to get your money out. You guys had to have known at that point, okay, things are about to get really bad.
Yes. It was, how should I explain it? You just sit on your house, you know, you shouldn't go out and get into any trouble, of course. In one way, you want to go and participate in the protests and all that, but you know it's not safe. So, yeah, I prefer to watch it on TV and be an spectator, not get involved in all that. Soon enough, people started getting very mad. I mean, we had like unemployment of 25%, and we had a poverty getting worse and worse. People had been without jobs for 6 months, a year, and they were very upset. So soon enough, they started, well, with the looting, what happened in the 19th of December, of 2001.
Oh, that's when it started, the 19th of December.
That's when the looting started, when there was a general uprise in the population all across the country, in the main downtown area of Buenos Aires, but also in the other cities as well. It was
right.
pretty much out of control for a couple of days. Yeah, it lasted, I mean, the rioting, all that maybe lasts for a week, but even after that, you still saw different situations where protesters would show up at a supermarket and demand food. If not, they would loot the place. I was actually in one of the supermarkets when that happened. The clerks
oh, wow.
started running around and forming barricades with the shopping carts. But they actually reached a peaceful resolution, so they surrendered the goods and shopping bags, and the looters, or the would-be looters, took it and just left.
Now, you had a little bit of time there between when the rioting actually started and you guys getting your money out of the bank. Did you make some preparations in between that time?
Well, I already participated. I went shooting by then. I had already taken my first defensive shooting class when I was 15 years old, so I already had guns in my house. We didn't have much preparations. For example, we didn't have enough food as I would have liked, but we didn't have any problem nonetheless. But that's one of the things that I now see, that if I hadn't, if things had gotten worse, if the revolt had lasted longer, then I saw that I didn't have enough food for such a thing. You know, people don't realize it, but when these things happen, supermarkets are either closed or the goods are not getting there. So even if you have the money, which most people didn't because the accounts were soon frozen, so you have double trouble because you had
right.
you didn't have the money, the ATMs had run dry, banks were closed, and the supermarket situation was complicated because even if they opened every now and then, people showed up demanding food or just looting it. Even small stores got looted, and in some cases, even the private houses, private property got looted as well. I know of a person that he was in the hospital when all this went on, and he had his house picked clean. They even took the toilets.
Oh, wow. That's
yeah.
crazy.
He had a good amount of gold stash, and he had some weapons. But he had the bad luck of being hospitalized at that time, and they realized the house was empty, so they looted it.
Lost his gold and his guns and everything in his house, including
yeah.
the kitchen sink.
Everything,
and the
just because he had a heart problem, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And you know,
now,
it's your same neighbors, the people that you think you can trust, because this was something that happened within his neighborhood. The word got around, and they knew he wasn't home, and so they looted his house.
Oh, so this was just his neighbors. This wasn't like roving bands of gangs or anything. This was his neighbors.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I mean. It was people within his neighborhood that knew he was hospitalized. So the word got to the wrong ears, and that's what happened to him. So,
were you in a major city then? Were you more in a smaller city? What type of environment were you in?
I was in the suburbs of Buenos Aires, in where was my parents' house. And it was a very good position to be in because it's a solid brick house and it has a fence up front where it meets the sidewalk. So it was a well-defendable place. And one thing I always mention is that day when the looting started after the revolt of December 19th, I woke up and heard drums because I didn't know at first what they were, just drums, like Indians. And it was the looters coming from down the road, a mass of people that just had been in a supermarket. So, yeah, in those moments, you just think, what would you do if they turn around? I mean, they were just like 20 yards away from where I was. If they turn around and they just try to go to your place, how will you react? What would you do?
I think the ARFCOM favorite adrenaline dump happens at that point.
Yeah.
When you say there's a mass of looters, how many people would you say there were in that situation where they were just 20 feet away?
Yeah,
from
I'm here? Talking about a mass of a human mass that went from building to building, covering the entire street and the sidewalk, and was probably half a block long. A lot of people.
Oh wow! So you're talking a thousand, a couple thousand people.
Yeah. Yeah, because it was in this the pockets of where poverty was more concentrated, where you knew that were the toughest neighborhoods. In those places was where these guys got together and incentivated one another to go loot places. You know what I mean?
Right.
They feel safe within the crowd. They feel immune and they feel above the law because they get mixed in the crowd. So they start doing things they normally wouldn't.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the police response to these looters. Was it a shoot-on-sight type of thing when the police and the military came in? Was it more of using fire hoses and tear gas? Or what did they try to do to disperse some of these crowds?
Well, during those days, it depends who you ask, but give or take, it was like 25, 30 people got killed or murdered in different situations. Usually the cops would just fire a few rounds of less than lethal buckshot. And that would send the looters away, or tear gas. They used all these commonly known tactics to disperse the crowds. And it actually works. I mean, people don't like getting shot at with anything. So when that happens, I mean, I went, a few days later, I went to the gun store and buy some more ammunition. And the guy was telling me that he had sold out all the less than lethal ammunition he had for 12-gauge shotgun because the shop owners were buying it to disperse the crowds in case their stores got looted.
Yeah. Tell me about the gun laws in Argentina. What are the laws like there? Is anyone allowed to own a weapon? Is it registered? Or what are the laws there?
Yeah, you need to have a gun user license, which you'll get from the equivalent of your BATF. So you need that license. To get that license, you need to pass a psychiatrist test, and you need to prove a way of earning a living, and you need a certificate that you're capable of using firearms by a certified instructor. That's what you need to get your firearms license. With that license, you can buy firearms, handguns, all types of handguns, bolt-action rifles, pump-action shotguns. It's the only thing that is complicated is magazine-fed semi-auto rifles, centerfire ones. Those are very hard to get and are usually very restricted unless you have a collector's license.
Oh, okay.
Which takes nearly a year to get, and it has to be approved by the Senate and may be refused even after you pay everything and wait all that time. So very, very few people have that type of weapons in Argentina.
You have to have connections to get those type of weapons, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, mostly you need patience, and now it's pretty much impossible. They're not giving it anymore. But in the old days, those of us that took the time to go through all the red tape and all the bureaucracy, some of us managed to achieve it, even without much contact. But the thing is, the lesson there is doing things when it's possible, you know? It's sometimes people think, oh, I have to do this, pay the seller tax or whatever, and they don't realize that there may be one day not that far away when there's no other way of getting anything, no matter how hard you try.
And then it's just too late and you're screwed. Yeah, that's a very good point. A lot of people think, you know, oh, I don't need to go get my long guns right now. I've got a couple handguns.
Yeah.
I've got a shotgun.
Yeah, and one day it's going to be too late. You're going to go and there's not going to be any other options. It's just going to be no as an answer.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you were you, when you went to the ammo store after the unrest had started and there were looters, was ammo even available, the calibers you needed, or was it very scarce and expensive?
There was ammunition. Mostly, there wasn't much variety. I mean, I'm now in Texas and I see what you guys have, and that's not how it works in Argentina. In Argentina, you have like four or five boxes of each caliber, maybe 10 if it's a big gun store, but it's not as plentiful. They were selling a lot of ammunition, especially in the common calibers that most people had, but it hadn't disappeared from the shelf yet. That's also because there's not as many gun owners in Argentina as there are in the USA. I could easily see how that same situation here in America would end up with ammo shortages.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have ammo shortages when we don't have civil unrest.
I know. Imagine when you have true civil unrest spreading all over the country, people would go nuts and buy everything they find.
That's a frightening situation.
So the lesson is having enough ammunition for the famous rainy day. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Now, you said you were in the house, in your parents' house. How many people were living there? Was it all adults? Was it adults and children? What was kind of the makeup of the people there?
Yeah, well, it was me and my mother. My father was traveling back and forth to Spain because he was already trying to relocate. But it was mostly me and my sister and my mother.
Okay, so you were the only male there, so you had to feel some sort of, I've got to protect my sister and my mom.
Yeah, yes.
Are your sister and your mother proficient with firearms at all?
No, not at all, no. No, so they're not, and... Yeah, a lot of different scenarios cross my head in that moment when you see the people going just so close from your house.
Was there ever a time, aside from that one time when they were that close to the house, where maybe you were out on the streets or still at the house and you thought, oh man, it's going down right now. I'm gonna have to shoot somebody.
Well, without getting into very specific situations. That happens a lot these days in Argentina, even now, because,
oh, wow,
especially in the suburbs, if the protesters that started the looting back then, they ended up in the welfare programs of the government, and now they're practically government employees, and they have total liberty to do whatever they want, cut any road they want, block the streets whenever they feel like it, even in support of the government, which makes no sense whatsoever, because, you know... It makes no sense to any reasonable people, but that's the way it is. They have absolute liberty to do anything they want. They can easily pull you out of your car and beat you up, and they're not going to go to jail because most of them are government employees. So
That
kind of thing happens a lot in Argentina, and you try to avoid it by any means necessary.
Absolutely. Now, are you allowed to carry a handgun with you on your person?
No, it's not legal to do that in Argentina.
Okay. Okay, I'm not
unless you have your own company and you prove that you have a lot of money and you need to protect the money. In Argentina, the law clearly says that the gun you would be carrying is just protecting the money you have, not your person.
Oh,
so
wow.
It works very well for the elite that has their own companies, you know? So they're not carrying for themselves. They're carrying to protect the money. Now, the poor guys that have to work and have to go to bad neighborhoods, they're not allowed to carry.
Right. So you say things are still pretty bad in Argentina. Has it gotten any better since 2002? What are the changes from when it was total rioting to now?
Well, the rioting and all the looting, that lasted, it's hard to say exactly how long it lasted because even if it calmed down in some areas, in some other parts, some wise guy would get together and demand stuff in a supermarket or a store or just take advantage of lack of police presence. But give or take, I mean, the first couple of weeks were the worst, then maybe it lasted for a month. Now the thing is that we haven't gotten any better. I mean, the country isn't half of what it used to be when we had the peso pegged to the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
But what has happened is that the country has changed in ways that a lot of us don't like at all. It's gone into a socialist, Chavez-like country, if you understand what I'm saying. It's not getting better. It's just changing into something else. The you go into an Argentine university these days and you see Mao communist flags in the middle, in the center of the hall.
Oh, wow.
That was totally, you would never have thought that would have happened if just a year before the crisis.
Yeah, that's scary. Now, is it true that things got so bad financially that the government actually took over people's retirement accounts?
Yes, it is true, and people don't seem to believe that, but yes, it happened. And it was made in such a way that they ended up having a surprisingly amount of press support by journalists that were saying that it's a good thing because capitalist private companies are bad, so it's better if your money is in the hands of the state. That's what I mean when things have changed, not gotten any better. They took people's money from their private pension funds and took it for themselves, basically. They stole people's money.
Yeah, that's theft. Yeah, that is just amazing. That is just crazy. So how is gold or silver as far as something to use back when the riots were going on? Is it something you would suggest to people to have a large amount of precious metals on hand for those type of situations? I know you guys had massive inflation and maybe having gold or silver would have helped. Or is it a situation where you had no way to spend it, so you were better off with food instead of the gold?
Well, I'm sure if any Argentine had a time traveling machine, they would go back in time and buy either dollars or gold. Either one would have saved their money from what happened with the peso losing 66%
right.
of its value. Any sane Argentine would take the chance to do that if they could. It's surprising because I'm now seeing here in Texas the I buy gold signs that back when it started in Argentina here it was completely unheard of. People, I remember talking about this in the different forums, and people say, well, here we don't do that thing about buying gold. What's that? Buying gold? Are you crazy? Why would they sell junk jewelry gold? That has no value. And now I'm here, and I'm seeing these signs just as we saw in Argentina, and we still do, about just any average Joe putting up a sign and buying gold if someone goes around and sells it to them.
Right.
So, yes, if it's a way to protecting, it's a way of protecting your savings, at least part of it.
Right.
I'm not saying just get rid of everything you have and go buy gold, but honestly, it's very easy to see how it's the only way in which you can protect your savings.
Now, were you able to use that gold during the times of crisis? Were you able, if you had gold, would you have been able to convert that into food or dollars or whatever in order to buy it and provide for your family?
Yes, I mean, at first when banks were closed and every other financial institution was closed, those first days, what I usually tell people, it's important to have cash in hand because during those times, you cannot drop by a serious dealer and sell gold for a good price. So it's better to have your cash in hand for those emergencies. After that, yeah, sure, you would go to a good place downtown and sell your gold for whatever it was worth in the market. The thing is, okay. You had to be careful because you wouldn't just be selling it into any I buy gold place because, first of all, you wouldn't be getting much of a good price, and second, you would be attracting a lot of unwanted attention.
Right.
So it wasn't a good idea to drop by and sell a gold eagle because
right.
it would easily be targeting you as a potential victim.
You go and sell it to the guy, and then he calls his buddies and say, follow that guy home because he's got gold.
I mean, yeah, if you're the only guy that dropped by in like a month with a gold coin, you're going to be very clearly pointed out.
Absolutely.
So if you have that alternative, it's just better to go to a better place that specializes on that, on trading with precious metals and getting the good price and going to a place where it's not going to be attracting too much attention for you.
Sure. Okay. In 1933 here in America, the government asked for people to voluntarily return their gold to the government. Actually, it was gold confiscation. Did your government do anything like that?
No, mostly because there wasn't that much gold to begin with. We didn't have that culture of gold. What happened was that mostly the I buy gold places, they were after gold jewelry. People that, you know, didn't have money were losing everything, but they had maybe a couple pieces of gold jewelry they would be selling in those places. Also, as well, I mean, you have to admit, there is an important market for those that are stealing it on the streets, snatching gold chains and such. stealing gold jewelry from the people. That's something that gets done a lot. It got to a point where, I mean, these days you hardly see women other than in some very safe places. You don't see women with gold chains and gold jewelry a lot because it gets snatched out of your neck directly.
I just wanted to kind of make it a comparison. You've traveled to the United States extensively. You've lived in Argentina. In the United States, it's much easier for people to own guns, especially in a place like Texas, where it's quite easy to own guns. In Argentina, it's a lot harder. Do you feel safer when you come to America and you're out on the streets than you do when you're in Argentina?
Yeah, yes. It's just a different world. I knew it was different, but until I came here, it's just another, it's not another planet, it's another galaxy entirely. I mean, I relax here in a way that I'm just now starting to get used to it after 2 weeks, because I can't believe that people leave things in their car and doesn't broken into immediately as soon as you turn your back. People walk relaxed, not worrying about getting robbed at gunpoint at any moment. It's just so different.
Wow, that's crazy. And now you have to go back. As soon as you get used to this, now you have to go back and be on
state
of alert.
Yes,
again.
That's why I'm not worried about getting too used to this, because I know I'm going to be back there in just a couple of days.
It's just amazing the differences between countries that have freedoms and countries that are more restricted. Now, let's go back to a little bit more about talking about Spit Hits the Fan. I've read some of your stuff, and you tend to say that having a handgun for an urban situation is more viable than a long gun.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Go ahead and give us some of the reasoning behind that and the tactic behind that.
The handgun is less accurate. You have less power. You have less capacity. It's worse in so many regards. But the one thing that a handgun can do is being with you at all times, and that's the key advantage it provides. So if something happens, like the stuff we were talking about before, about you just not knowing where you're going to be facing trouble. If you're driving down the street and you find these guys that are just pulling people out of their cars, if you come against one of these roadblocks and you actually have to end up defending yourself, and you were just, going to the supermarket and to buy something, you weren't expecting to run into trouble.
Trouble
doesn't send an invitation. It just happens. Even if it's just exiting your vehicle and walking to the front of your door, your house, it's going to happen in the moment you're expecting it the least. So you never have a rifle with you in those times. It's not realistic to expect to do so. If you're lucky enough, by all means, get a better weapon. But having your handgun with you at all times, it's a terrific advantage when there's such a high crime situation going on.
The logic behind that makes an awful lot of sense, especially for that urban
environment. People have to understand that you have to take advantage of the possibilities you have in this country. I can't get it why people don't get their concealed carry permits when they can, when it's illegal for them to do it. It would be such a great advantage in my situation to be able to do that. You have to get used to it now before you actually need it in a much more dangerous environment. If things get worse, you're going to be already used to having your handgun with you.
A lot of wisdom in that statement. Was there ever a time during the rioting and the social unrest that you guys had power outages and you were without power for an extended period of time?
Well, the longest we've been in Buenos Aires without power was, I think it was 5 days a week. And we usually had problems with water as well, because the infrastructure just wasn't in good condition. And it got worse when the companies had to buy every replacement piece and everything from abroad in dollars now, which was 3 or 4 times more expensive. So the infrastructure has suffered a lot in all the possible spectrum you can think of. So we had problems with water, with the electricity. We had problems with them, sometimes being without them for a few hours or a day or two in occasions. If something happened, mostly during summer when the demand of electric power increases and the demand of water rises as well, you usually had these problems. So it was a very good idea to have enough water stored ahead.
When you
and
say
for,
that
for the power outage, you ended up using lots of flashlights, using lots of batteries, so it was a good idea to have rechargeable ones. Now there's the low discharge rate ones that are much better, and you can keep them charged and recharge them when power comes back up. That's a very nice idea and something neat to have.
Right, absolutely. Now, you say the longest you were without power was 5 days. Was that citywide, or was that in your small area?
No, that happened in the downtown area of Buenos Aires. It didn't affect me. I didn't go through those 5 days without power. That was
okay.
In the main district of the capital district of Buenos Aires, yeah.
Okay. Is that a residential district, or is that more businesses and stuff like that?
It's both. You have lots of residential buildings. Mostly the problem was with people stuck in elevators or people that couldn't just walk the stairs, you know?
Oh,
people that lived in a 10th floor, imagine being without power for a week without being able to use the elevator. So it's good advice to staying in proper shape and in good health as well as you can.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is a great conversation. I love asking you these questions. Now, people think about preparing for bad times, and they think of water, food, guns and ammo, and you spoke a little bit about batteries and things, but what were a couple of things that you guys ended up needing that you didn't, that wasn't necessarily maybe on your list of things to prepare for, and you found out, oh man, you know what, we need this pretty bad, and we didn't even think about this?
Well, one of the things maybe is water filters. It's something that people think you're going to be using when bugging out into the woods, and you find a small stream and you filter water. Well, we use those in our houses every day, and most Argentine people do, because the water we get, the tap water we get, is usually contaminated. I once got a bill from the water company telling me that the water that they were providing was okay, was nice and all, but it shouldn't be consumed by children under the age of 3 or pregnant women because it could be dangerous.
Oh,
so
wow.
It kind of makes you think, why is it not okay for children to drink it and they're still selling it to you? So, yeah, it has heavy metals and it has a lot of bleach, because that's the only way they have to ensure that it doesn't have even worse organism in it. So you have to filter it just to be safe to drink.
Right.
So you have your tabletop filter, and you use it on a daily basis for preparing food, drinking water, and everything. So a water filter is pretty much critical, especially if you think that something like that could happen here, if there may be a day when the water company isn't providing the kind of service it is able to provide these days. If that happens, you're still going to be having tap water, but not of the same quality.
Were there any things that you guys found that you were needing that you didn't have, and maybe you had to improvise in order to create a workaround for it?
It's very hard to think of one single thing. I mean, it wasn't as if you couldn't find things. You had just... It was a bit harder to find, but most of all, the problem was being able to pay for them, because everything was now getting imported. You know what I mean? For example, if you wanted the good rechargeable batteries, they were expensive. And if you had bought them before the crisis, when the peso was pegged to $1, one peso, you would have bought them for a much better price. Same thing for every piece of gear you can think of. So that's why it's important to have important stuff. It's important to buy it now and not think, well, I'm going to be able to get it later, and I'm going to be able to get it at a reasonable price as well. You never know when things change, and you end up paying 2 or 3 times as much as you did before, or even more.
Here in America, over the last couple of years, there has been a huge resurgence of people doing their own gardens at their house or in their backyard, and people owning chickens. Has that been something that you've noticed in Argentina, that now there are more people with gardens and more people that have chickens and that type of thing?
There is a bit of an increase in the amount of home gardens and orchards, but mostly it's people trying to find other ways of making money, because for some reason money ends up being more practical than actually growing the items you need yourself. It has been much more noticeable, the amount of people going into their own little businesses, trying to sell stuff online, trying to, I don't know, make their own products, make their own bath soaps, and making their own home business.
Right.
Okay, making their own way, their own source of income, trying to have a home business of some kind, anything at all, just something that makes a few bucks for them. that happened a lot, and you can hardly find one family where, because of the crisis, they didn't use the resources and what they knew, what they had in hand, to make an extra income if they could.
Before I let
because
you go,
in the end, money ends up being much more practical.
Sure.
I mean, you end up needing it for much more things. It's much more practical than actually growing the food. That's perfectly okay, but having money, many times, it's even better.
Now, before I let you go, is there anything that you want to say to people that we didn't touch on? Anything, some words of wisdom or some advice maybe that I didn't have a chance to bring up, or that you think is very important for people to understand when they think maybe something like this might be coming along?
Well, probably that the most important part of this, and many of the guys already know it, it's the mindset you have. It's not, I mean, there's gear that you need, absolutely, and you cannot materialize it when you need it, no matter how much mindset you have and how smart you are. If you don't have a weapon with you when you need it, you're not going to change that situation. If you don't have the food supply already stocked, and the water, most importantly, water, which is something that a lot of people just don't think enough about it. A common mistake is having, for example, containers of water and not having them actually filled. So they somehow expect that they're going to get some warnings to fill all those containers up when they need, and it's not going to work that way. It's one day you're going to try to get a bath and there's not going to be any water coming out of it.
Right.
So it's important to have it already at hand. That's something that's maybe the most overlooked aspect of people that already are into survival and preparedness. The mindset, it's by far the most important aspect. It affects absolutely everything in your life. You have to incorporate all these things. It's not just about getting online at night as a way of relaxing and talking about these things with people, with like-minded folks. You actually have to live this way and think this way as something with which you do just everything in your life. It has to be a way of life, as a friend of mine said.
Basically living the Boy Scout motto, be prepared, turning that into your lifestyle.
Yes, being prepared at all times.
Before I let you go, I've got to ask you the two questions I ask all ARFCOMers. They are the two life-changing, humanity-defining questions on AR15.com. The first one is, of course, 9mm or 45?
9mm.
9mm, okay. And the second one, I think you know what's coming. In Chile, are you beans or no beans?
No beans.
Oh, no beans. Okay. You're in Texas, so you had to answer that or they wouldn't have let you out of there.
Yeah, I've been having plenty of beans, but yeah. Other than for stocking up, I prefer lentils.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. Now, my very last question for you. Since you've been here in the States, have you been able to hook up with any ARFCOMers at all?
Yeah, actually, yeah, with Halfast.
With who?
Halfast, the writer of...
Oh, really?
Lights Out.
That's great. Yeah, that's fantastic. I've always wanted to interview him. Hopefully, why don't you tell him to send me an email or IM so that I can get him on the show as well, okay?
Okay, he's a great guy, yeah. He's a very nice guy.
He sounds like it. He sounds like it. That's great. Okay. I could just imagine the conversations the two of you guys have together. Boy, I'd love to sit in on one of those.
Yeah, it was nice meeting him.
Well, hey, Fernando, I want to thank you for taking some time out of your vacation to give everybody here at AR15.com an insight, a direct line straight into what it was like living through the spit hitting the fan there in Argentina. I wish you the best of luck. Be safe when you get back down there, and please stay in contact with me, okay?
Okay, thanks a lot. Take care.
Thanks a lot, Fernando. That's Fernando. His name is Fairfall308. I'm sure you guys all know who he is as ARFCOMers, especially if you spend any time at all in the survival forum. And if you don't, you ought to get there. Once again, want to thank him for a great interview. What an interesting conversation that was with Fairfall. I could have gone on and on for hours with that guy. I had to edit it down to make it fit into the show today. But just an interesting situation he had to live through and the perspective that he has on it, we can learn a lot from. For those that don't know, he's got his own blog. It's fairfall.blogspot.com. He's also an author. He's got a book called The Modern Survival Manual, Surviving the Economic Collapse, by Fernando Fairfall Aguirre. It's available on Amazon. The reviews from it have been all top-notch. I think it's like 4.5 or 5-star book on Amazon. So it's got some really good stuff in there. For beginning preppers, hardcore survivalists, just people that are interested about what it was like to live through a situation where your entire economy and your whole life basically collapses around you, your whole society. just what an amazing story. Thanks a lot, Fairfowl, for being on the show. Well, let's move right along. Last segment of the show, I've been waiting for a couple of months to get these guys on. Jansen Jones and Rob Romero of the Noveski Shooting Team. Are you guys there?
Here, man.
Outstanding. Rob, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, cool. I don't even know where to start with you guys. I got a million questions. I hear you guys are just tearing it up out there on the circuit right now. Congratulations, Rob. I know you just won one of the shootouts at the FN Herstal Midwest 3-gun. Is that right?
Yeah, it was the FN 3-gun match out in Missouri a couple weeks ago.
So why don't we start back at the beginning? You guys tell me how you got involved in shooting to begin with, and then kind of what led you and what was your path towards shooting 3-gun. We'll start with you, Rob.
Well, I've been shooting for about 3.5-4 years, and, you know, like most of the people in 3-gun, started out with pistol and shooting on USPSA matches, shooting production and some other divisions, and then it just was a natural progression. You know, you get to, you're always looking for that high that you get when you first, I mean, the first couple of matches I ever shot, I mean, you're scared, your pulse is up, you're shaking, everybody's behind you watching you, you're nervous, and then just after a certain couple of years of experience, it goes away. You know, you kind of know what you're supposed to do. Mentally, your game is right, and you just get out there and handle it. And then, you know, you get into 3-gun, and, you know, you're juggling 3 guns, sometimes all 3 of them on one stage, and, you know, it keeps everything fresh, and there's just more problems to be solved, and it's just the natural progression as a shooter to look for bigger and better, just go out there and try to, you know, prove yourself and, you know, that you got what it takes to be out there, so...
So how did you get originally started in shooting? Did your dad have you shooting when you were young? Were you a hunter, or how did you originally get started?
It's funny because I was a kid. I always played with guns and played Army and went to the Army surplus store. And I discovered girls around the middle, and kind of playing with guns just wasn't an issue or a passion. None of my family ever did it. And one of my little cousins, he would go hunting. He got an AR-15 and I just looked at it, and I was like, you know, what are you going to do with that thing? And then I got out and we shot it, and I was hooked. Okay, I started getting into pistols and getting into guns, and went to my range and started reloading, got into reloading some 308, some bench stuff, and, you know, the range behind the regular pistol range behind it, there was some pits back there, and I just heard people ripping their guns. You know, it sounded like full auto or cowboy stuff, shooting steel, and, you know, 3 years later, I got my nerve to walk back there and see what was part of it, because I was part of the club, and I was allowed to go back there. I went back there, and there were just regular guys out there with, you know, badass guns on their hips and open guns, and went back there, gave it a shot, you know, learned how to draw and not sweep my hand and, you know, do it, you know, safely and efficiently, and just it took off from there. I shot my first match, and I won, and I was basically hooked. When I lived in California and before I moved to Georgia, it was just, you just run around and be fast. And when I moved to Georgia, just the caliber of shooter that I was shooting against out here was just extremely different, completely different, accurate and fast. And it was just a whole other thing. And, you know, there was plenty of progression left. And there was a lot of GMs and grandmasters on this side of the country that I had never had the privilege to shoot with or even see them in action other than on TV. So, you know, one thing led to another, started, you know, trailing some big shooters around and watching them and picking up stuff. And, you know, just you put in the work and, you know, you get out what you put in the sport. So I basically dumped it all into it. So I've seen a lot of good return on it.
Yeah, that's awesome. We'll talk a little bit more about some of the results you guys have had. Jansen, why don't you go ahead and tell us about from when you first started shooting your road all the way up to shooting competitive 3-gun. Jansen, are you there?
Yeah, hey, I don't know. I guess my phone's cutting it out.
Stand by that window, man.
I know. It must be my,
find that sweet
my lack
spot.
Of reception here.
I don't know if you heard your
question. I can hear you guys. Oh, go ahead.
Okay, go ahead. Jansen, why don't you tell us from your road, from your first time shooting to shooting competitively in 3-gun.
Well, I actually went out to my first match in 2004. At a club that's now defunct. It was the Collin County IDPA, just north of Dallas. And I shot with them on and off through college. And then I took a break. I started law school, actually, and moved to Georgia. And I met the person that actually got me into 3-gun big time through AR15.com, Todd Litt, who's actually a member of the Noveski shooting team, and he actually put me in touch with Rob. And, you know, I actually credit a lot of my success to both Rob and Todd, and that's really how I got started into three gun was through pistol shooting, but more directly through Todd Litt and AR15.com.
That's cool that you found him through ARFCOM. Now, when did you start shooting? Did your family, are you guys family big on guns and hunters and shooting sports, or was it something you had to develop on your own?
It's a family thing. You know, I'm from the Midwest. My parents are all from the Midwest, and hunting is actually just a big part of our culture. And so I grew up around firearms, but it was always in a hunting, you know, sports of field type aspect. And when I got to college, I obviously didn't have time to go take off 3 or 4 days and go live in the woods, but I'd see, you know, video on TV of pistol shooters and the really fast shooting, and it really intrigued me. So I went out to a local IDPA match, and I watched for the very first match. I just stood there and watched and thought, you know, this is something I can do. I just needed to make sure that I had, you know, a holster and two mag pouches for IDPA. And the next week that they had another match, I was out there with my buddy, and we were competing. So it was really pretty simple.
That's really cool. Now, for people that want to shoot three gun, and I'm one of those people, but you look on TV and you watch some of the videos of these guys shooting, and you're just like, I am not going to go out there and make an absolute fool of myself. Like, the threshold and overcoming that first, that fear, what kind of advice do you have for someone who they want to do three gun, but, you know, let's be honest, it's intimidating. You see some of these guys shooting. I mean, it's intimidating.
You got to just buck up and make an ass out of yourself is really what you got to do. My first match, I must have shot. I shot it with a Mini 14, a Glock 19, and an 870. And I didn't get anything done. I couldn't hit nothing. I couldn't hit nothing with the pistol. I couldn't hit anything with the rifle. I mean, you know, Mini 14s, they work in theory. But when you get out there and, you know, when you put a timer on your ear and there's guys watching, you can't hit the broadside of a barn with one of those things. So, I mean, just like everybody, just that biggest hurt. Then you get out there and you're like, oh, man, I wasted 3 years standing around watching all this fun go by and the progression level. I got where I got, and I'm thinking if I can add 3 more years to my experience, I would be twice as good as I am now. You know, you almost look back and, you know, I wonder what I'd have attained if I had started a lot earlier. You know, you would have been, because it's starting really to take off now, and the guys who have been around it for the last 5 to 10 years are really at the forefront. They're at the top of the game. They're the only ones doing it. So, you know, there's a lot of new shooters coming up, but we've had, the learning curve is a lot steeper. We have to learn and shoot a lot more matches and get out to a lot of venues just to kind of catch up with the experience level of some of the big, you know, top name shooters. So all I can say is just bring whatever you have, go out and do it, because you're going to kick yourself. You're like, I can't believe I put this off for so long because I didn't want to, you know. If you know 100 yard zero, you can hit a piece of paper at 10 yards and you can mediocrely, you know, or you can load your shotgun mediocre. You'll have fun and you'll it's a coolest group of people you're going to meet. You know, the most generous guys, they'll hand you their shotgun. You bring ammo, they'll let you shoot everything they got. And, you know, there's not many sports out there where you're actively giving your competition tips. You know, I'm telling people how to shoot the stage who I'm shooting against when it boils down to it is, you know, you got to shoot it. I'm not holding your gun for you, but you have to help guys get past the mental block of trying to strategize what's the best way to shoot it. Where do I do my reloads? What's a good position to get in? What's a good transitional position for my rifle to my shotgun? You know, just, you won't meet a cooler bunch of people that will, you know, if you wanted to, would help you every step of the way. But it's definitely just get out there and do it.
And that's a reoccurring theme I hear from every three-gun shooter is that, you know, you get to these events and everybody there literally will bend over backwards. All these guys that you see on TV, they'll come and give you tips and equipment and go ahead.
It's one of the things that bothers me. You always see, like, you know, you see posts, oh, those guys are gamers, or those guys are this. And I'm just like, who are these people? Because I don't know who they're talking about. You know, we're all out there, we're playing a game, so of course we're gamers. We're trying to, you know, you know, the structure is freestyle. You know, whose idea is the best idea? You know, and if it's clearly defined within the rules of what you can and cannot do, if you're not cheating or breaking the rule, you just thought of something that no one else thought of. And most of the time it only happens once, because as soon as someone sees you do it, they're like, well, obviously that's a better way to do it. So, you know, it just, my experience, you know, there's always one or two bad apples at a match. And, you know, it's in any gun community in the circle. I was telling Jansen, we're at matches, and, you know, there's a group of people and we're standing in a circle, you know, BSing, and there's always a couple of people who, you know, you don't know them. They kind of don't know what they're talking about. They're kind of acting like they know what they talk. That circle just gets smaller, you know. The circle of people, like, who's this guy, you know. There's people who want to genuinely come out and learn, and they kind of listen and stand back. But those guys that come out and try to know it all and tell people who, you know, they don't know what they're doing, trying to explain how to do stuff. And you just kind of, it's a tight-knit group of guys that you see every weekend on the circuit. I see the same guys week in and week out at pistol matches. So, I mean, these tend to be your buddies, you know, more than just acquaintances. So, you know, you see those people out there shooting fast, and you stand back and, you know, I wonder if I can get in and do this. And you just jump in, and, you know, you'll thank yourself for getting out there and actually get to use the guns and actually get to play with them in the capacity that, you know, that they were made for. Actually get them out and ring them out and see what they're capable of. And you find out what works and what doesn't work really fast. So.
Yeah, Rob's right. We had a friend of ours that we shoot with. His first multi-gun match ever happened to be the Area 6 multi-gun championship last October. He saw me in the gym with a three-gun t-shirt on and said, hey, I'd like to do this. And I said, well, next weekend's the Area 6 multi-gun championship. You can register at the match. Just show up with the entry fee, your three guns. You know, we'll help you get through it. And sure enough, he showed up and paid his entry fee, and he needed some help on one stage. We pulled out some tools, took off his vertical foregrip, and he got through the match in good shape. And in fact, he's been one of our traveling partners ever since.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, so he just saw you at the gym with your t-shirt on, and now he's one of your guys that goes all the tournaments with you.
I mean, he
looked at me in the gym and said, hey, do you shoot USPSA IPSC and three gun? I said, well, yeah. His stepfather actually used to shoot, and didn't really think he'd ever, you know, take it interesting, the competitive nature of it. And he said, well, I'd like to try it. We brought him out for a championship level match, and he's been hooked ever since, you know.
That's really cool. Great story. Now, I want to remind all the listeners, these guys are giving away some T-shirt and sticker, Noveski T-shirt and sticker packages. If you want to call in, get your call on the air, and they'll send you out a T-shirt and sticker package. The number to call in, 530-413-4511 or 530-413-4515. Go ahead and call in. We'll get you on the air with both Jansen and Rob. We've actually got a caller online already, so I'll go ahead and get him so he doesn't have to stay on hold. Ben from Georgia on B3, you are on with the Noveski three-gun team. Ben, are you there?
Yes. Hey, can you hear
Ben?
Me? Hello?
Miles!
this is the guy that I was just talking about.
Oh! Okay, well, you don't get a sticker or a t-shirt package.
Yeah, this is Ben Powell. He's actually the guy that I was just telling the story about.
Oh, okay. So, Ben, they said you were in the gym, you saw him wearing his three-gun shirt, and you said, I want to do it, and that weekend you were at the championships.
Exactly. I thought, you know, I've always wanted to do it, so I asked him, and turns out he shot three-gun. So I got very lucky in that aspect.
And, yeah, I'll say it.
Went to the match, squatted with, I think, Rob, and I think Todd was also there. It was actually in the super squad, and I don't know who any of these people were. I don't know how good they were, but it was remarkable how friendly they were and how much they helped me.
Now, tell me about that first event. When you had to have been nervous that first time you went.
Oh, of course. I'd shot one pistol match before then. I showed up with a iron-sided AR-15, a 870, and a 1911. I shot tack irons and didn't really know what I was doing, but I struggled through it.
And how long ago was that?
That was, I believe, in November.
So that was November. Now we're in June. Did you go to any of these last few events that Jansen and Rob went to, like the FNH Midwest Championships?
Been at all of them.
Oh, yes. Exactly. I've traveled with them to Steel City, LaRue, FNH, and that's it.
So you've only been doing this for 7 months. Are you noticeably better?
Definitely. Probably my biggest improvement has been a shotgun, mainly due to Rob's assistance and teaching me actually how to reload.
Okay.
But
do you find that the three gun, it helps your shooting, like all your shooting, just when you're out shooting with your friends or whatever, I don't know if you hunt, does it affect that at all?
Definitely. Each different gun's unique, so the better you get with one gun, it carries over. So if you're shooting iron sights on a shotgun, it'll carry over to pistol. If you're shooting a scope rifle, it'll carry over if you shoot an open pistol. It all interacts, and it will think that if you shoot a wide variety of guns, you'll get better at them, definitely. But I think the key is to stay with one gun if you're serious about competing.
Now, before I let you go, Ben, when you guys practice together, do you guys compete against each other in practice?
Definitely. That's half the fun.
Have you found that you can beat these guys sometimes in practice?
Not a chance.
Not yet?
Not yet.
You'd be surprised how much this guy's improved in the course of, 7 months. I mean, he went from fresh fish to, he's out there banging away and you're walking back like, damn. He really, really, really blasted that stage. He burned that one down. So, I mean, he's made remarkable improvement. And, it's funny, like, when we go to the matches and, you help people out, I have no problem. I mean, Jansen's seen it. Todd's seen it. I'll bend over backwards to help any of the people who genuinely are looking for help. Those guys out there who are like, hey, can you give me a hand or help? I have no problem. This is the one thing most of the big shooters that you come in contact with, it's the people who ask for help who don't take it are the worst. That's kind of like the worst offense. you ask for the help, the guy sits down and talks to you for 10, 15 minutes, you break down a stage, and then all of a sudden it's like, I think I'm going to do it this way. And you're like, really? Thanks a lot. And a lot of the guys who actually take your advice see immediate results. They see immediate feedback of what works, what doesn't work, why, sometimes you can't really put in words exactly what you're trying to convey until they actually see it and do it, and then the register is like, oh, that's exactly why I went from that target to that target, because the transition to move from that point to that point as I was backing away made a lot more sense shooting that target as I came in on it. So just sometimes if you're gonna let these guys, some of the guys you're asking help from, if you're actually gonna take their advice and give it a shot, sometimes it's just not evident the importance of it until you actually devote it to a stage, give it a shot, go out there and shoot it the way you guys had broken it down. So, I mean, when you actually go out and do it, like Ben, he comes up to me, hey, what do you think? What are you going to do here? And, I've bounced ideas off of guys who just got in the sport, and they see stuff that you never saw. I'm like, I didn't even see that. I've had Ben go, hey, what about this? What do you think of this? And I'm looking at him like, good looking, because I didn't see that. I didn't even think about that, So you're constantly changing previous conceptions. I think to become a great shooter is just to have an open mind, be willing to not go out there and go, oh, I know exactly what I'm going to do. Because a lot of times I went out there and went, oh, I know exactly what I'm going to do. And then, why did I do that? And you walk away shaking your head and you see some new shooter tear it up. And you're like, that was so obvious. It was right in my face and I didn't even notice it. So,
Well, hey, thanks for calling in, Ben. That's a great story of someone who overcame that threshold, just went in head first, and now you've apparently made some great progress.
Yeah, Ben's awesome. He actually lives, close to where I live, and he travels with me to all the stuff. I'm not right near where Todd and Rob are, so Ben's been kind of like a traveling partner for me, too. And he's just a really good example of just jump into the game and don't look back.
Call in with any questions you have for Rob or Jansen. They're on the Noveski shooting team. The number's 530-413-4511 or 530-413-4515. Chris from Kentucky is on line B2. Chris, how are you?
All right. How you doing?
Doing great. You're on with Jansen and Rob. Ask them anything you want.
Okay. What would you consider to be the most economical route if you want to get into competitive shooting? just as a beginner?
That's a good question.
Like, probably
Glock.
You know, what's that?
Glock. I was going to say Glock pistol.
Yeah, production class Glock pistol is, you know, 9mm. You know, it's probably the best way. I use Glock. You can get in. You can get in probably, you know, for less than $1,000. Magazines, ammunition, pouches, holster, belt, you know, basic. I mean, a three-gun kind of got to morph your current existing armory. And, you know, most, I never went out and bought guns specifically for three-gun. I basically took what I already had and enhanced it or junked it or traded it up. You know, but definitely a Glock pistol or an M&P, any of the plastic striker-fired pistol will get you in the game probably quicker than any other high-end pistol.
What about shotguns? That was more another thing too, like on a three gun. What's the way to go with, you know, I guess an economical choice for shotguns?
Well, Danny, I don't know, Jansen. You've like tried them all. I'm kind of stuck with the same one.
Yeah, in the last 12 months, I've went through at least four different shotguns, an SLP Mark I, a couple of different Benellis, and a Benelli Supernova. And, you know, it's funny, I was talking to Rob about this again last week, but you can be very competitive with a pump shotgun, whether it's an 870. I really like the Benelli Supernova at this point, but, you know, if you've got an 870, go out and use it. Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid to compete with guys against, you know, running semi-autos. We had a local three-gun here, and for kicks, I decided to compete with my pump shotgun against everybody else using auto loaders, and on the one-speed shotgun stage, I took third. You know, Rob beat me, one other guy beat me, and everyone else shooting auto was under me. You know, it's kind of funny because everybody thinks you're at a disadvantage running a pump shotgun, and, you know, if you practice with it and become proficient with it, you're not at any disadvantage, in my opinion. I mean, you might be for a couple of technical aspects, but, you know, in general, start with what you've got. If it's an 870, go out and use it.
Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah, I was wondering what the competitiveness of a pump shotgun against a auto loading would be.
Well, on the other side of that coin too is, you know, with the practice you have in it, first of all, it's always going to run. You know, I mean, most of the gun pump guns I see go down is usually operator error. So, you know, if you're not short stroking it or get double feed, you're pretty much safe. You can use any ammo to the lightest, you know, two and three quarter dram. Light stuff, you can use all the low recoil, you know, slugs and bucks. So, you know, your recovery time is going to be less than, you know, I run 3.25 dram, you know, high velocity out of my M1 Super 90 just for the fact that it'll run all day. I mean, I can use 3 or 2.75 stuff, but for competition, I wouldn't even want to risk it, not to clear jams and whatnot, or, you know, clear failure to eject some stuff. But, you know, if you go out there with an 870, the trick is load it, you know, because everybody's going to be shooting that gun dry. So if you work on your reloads and, you know, your weak hand reloading, you can be just as competitive and you're going to be shooting probably a little bit faster because you can use any, you know, a lot of the low velocity, low recoil stuff.
Okay.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Why don't you send me an IM with your shipping information. I'll get it out to Jansen. They'll get you your T-shirt and sticker package, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot. Oh, we got another caller online, Colonel Hertz from Maryland, B3. How are you today, Colonel Hertz?
Work on your reload and reloading.
I can barely hear him, Seth. Is that him or?
That's him. I can barely hear him, too. Hmm.
Oh, I think he's listening to it on the radio. Colonel Hertz, are you there? He's got his radio up. That's what it is we can hear.
Wake up!
Colonel Hertz, going once, going twice. Seth, why don't you put him back on hold, see if we can get him on. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you guys was, what kind of setups do you run, and do you run the same setup every competition?
I've been shooting TAC optics. I've been running the same gun, same scope. I mean, once you kind of get married up with your equipment, and you know what to expect out of it, and you know, you got it down like the back of your hand. You try not to change it up. I mean, I'm probably going to start moving into a different division early next season or late this season just to kind of change it up because we all shoot the same division. So we're basically, we're all teammates, but we're all shooting against each other. So it kind of, it's, it, you know, you want your buddy to do well. You're like, damn, you know, he just burned that stage out. So it's bad enough I got to worry about everybody else, and not to mention my teammates. But yeah, once you find equipment that works, ammunition, a load that, you know, that you can depend on, you know, your pistol runs, you have spare parts, you start to amass contingencies for if your gun goes down in a match and whatnot, you tend to stick with the same stuff. I've seen more problems than, you know, just recently I just went and shot a different division for pistol this last weekend and put a new magwell on my 1911, and it was the worst mistake, but I had to shoot a match to find out. So once you get your stuff running, don't play with it. You know, that's probably about my advice on that.
And Rob,
you guys are shooting
something. Rob told me early on was use your local matches. You know, before you go shoot a major match, if you can, use the local matches to ring out all your gear and your equipment. You know, and I found that to be very true.
Yeah, that's good advice. Now you guys are on the Noveski team, so I assume you're shooting Noveski ARs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Correct.
What kind of setup do you run, Jansen?
Mine's a little different than Rob's. I'm using a 17-inch barrel with a rifle-length gas system with a 1-in-7 twist, and I believe Rob is using a 16-inch with a MIDI gas system.
You guys using vertical foregrips or no?
I've been using the Magpul AFG. I really like that thing. I mean, people look at it funny, but I've used it in a couple instances. It has definitely not held me back in any match. I wouldn't recommend a foregrip, but there's been some instances where I've had a distinct advantage using it. Kind of, you know, it'd be hard to explain just from getting into shooting off the top of a barrel, shooting off the top of a flat, like a flat surface, drop the handguard on the table, and I got my hand on that foregrip, so I'm not smashing my hand. I still have my normal grip on the end of the forearm, but it's just lifted enough off the table, push it forward into the magwell. I've definitely used, you know, that angled foregrip to my advantage on a few stages, you know, at a few different matches. But, you know, we all use PRS stocks, kind of weights the back of the gun, keeps all the weight from the mag back. You know, I'm using a short, we're using the Troy, what are they, the TRX or the Battle Rails, Jansen?
Yeah, the TRX rail.
And, you know, we're all trying different comps, and, you know, we're working on some different things. I prefer a 16-inch with a MIDI. I just, you know, it's shorter. Once you put a mag, you know, once you put a brake on the end of the gun, it grows about 2.5 inches. So my gun ends up being 18, you know, ends up being 18 to almost 19-inch barrel. So when you're swinging the gun in port to port and moving, you got to, you know, with a longer gun, you have to dismount and drop the barrel. That way I can just stand back and swing the gun from port to port without ever having to dismount the gun. So, I mean, we don't, you know, tend to shoot beyond 600 yards, 500 yards usually the max. That gun will reach out with 69s all day long. So, I mean, I don't feel I'm losing anything by having an inch or two less than an 18-inch or 17-inch barrel gun. I think I gain a little bit in weight and the mobility of it. So,
right.
We're all kind
I didn't realize you guys shoot at those kind of ranges. That's pretty impressive, actually.
And they're usually after you shoot your pistol and your shotgun, and you have to run 50 yards. So, yeah, they
what
don't,
kind of opposite?
You never.
Now,
they only
we
really
shot
start
one match.
The long range.
We shot one match in Texas, and they had us shoot like 12 or 15 pistol targets, and grab a rifle, run 50 yards, shoot a bunch of closed paper, and then hit the deck and shoot targets out to 440. I think that's the longest shot we've had so far this year.
Yeah,
wow.
That was the.
We've got Colonel Hertz back online, you guys. Let's see if we can get his call real quick. Colonel Hertz? Colonel Hertz.
Same thing.
Colonel Hertz.
Well, tell him to get a landline.
He needs to turn off his radio and keep his ear to the phone. What kind of optics are you guys running?
Go ahead.
Last year we were all using Swarovski Z6Is, and this year Schmidt and Bender was really gracious enough to want to support us, and so we're using their 1-4 short dot LE model, the reticles in the second focal plane. And I've actually liked it a lot better than the Swarovski. I think the dot is a lot more, I think it's brighter, and it's just more refined for the kind of shooting that we do.
Yeah, that Swarovski was a circle dot, and I really thought that, you know, six power, true one, I thought I really liked that circle dot a lot better, and I've been definitely shooting this Zenith model short dot a lot better, even though it's got four power. Surprisingly, you tend not to use all six power anyways. I mean, you usually will dial up to, you know, you'll zoom in and then you kind of zoom back till your field of view gives you better peripheral, so you can see the target that you actually have to go. You know, when you're running and your heart's pounding, you're on the clock, you tend to kind of lose focus. We're at LaRue match and I was shooting 100, 150, 250, and there's two targets at 250, two LaRues. Hit both those, went to the 300 in recoil, and I'm looking down and those LaRues had reset. I'm like, did I shoot those already? And then I ding, ding, shot them again. And they're like, why'd you shoot those targets twice? I was like, you know, you just start shooting stuff that's presented. And, you know, if it's knocked down steel and it comes back up, you know, the first thing you're like, I don't want to leave it standing. So you get lost sometimes up in the scope. So sometimes having that extra magnification is a detriment, not a plus.
Right. Now, I hinted earlier that you guys really have been tearing the scene up lately. Do you guys compete as a team? Does the team get recognition, or is it more of an individual thing as far as the recognition at the end of a shoot is concerned?
It's right now it seems to be more of an individual. You know, there was a team match at FN. We kind of stayed up too late and got a little inebriated, and we're just like, ah, it's a team match. We packed all our guns. We're like, I don't want to break all our guns out to shoot this. Last year, the team match was, they provided the guns. We shot a SCAR and a SLP and a I think they're FN-45, and we found it this year that we were going to, since they're using their match guns in the shoot-off, we were going to shoot, you know, the competitors would shoot their own guns in the shoot in the team event, and we're just like, ah, forget it. You know, we didn't have to pay to be in the team event. We just kind of breeze through it and just, you know, next time or something. But as of now, it's not really, they don't really recognize teams. There's not too many teams out there. I mean, there's DPMS and FN, but you know, a lot of the guys, you know, when you start getting sponsored, it's really hard to sponsor, get a sponsorship to cover more than one person. You know, so
right.
To get lucky enough to be on a team of a group of guys, a core group of shooters that you can kind of depend on and you kind of travel with is kind of a rare thing in the shooting world, you know, right now. Hopefully that'll change.
And it seems like you guys benefit from that, from being able to travel together, bounce ideas off each other and that type of thing.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and that was kind of how, you know, the team even came about. You know, I was shooting with these guys last year, and I just reached out to John Noveski and said, hey, you know, we're shooting these three guns, we're traveling together. Would you have any interest in maybe putting something together with us? And, you know, he was really welcoming and accommodating enough, and it just kind of blossomed into something that I don't think either Rob and I at this time last year really would have expected.
No, it was really just a trial thing. Hey, you know, we'll get a barrel to you, and you know, it's kind of really no strings attached. You know, we'll just see how where it goes, and you know, we had some videos, and Jansen's our faithful filmmaker, and took a lot of video and a lot of work. You know, there's a lot of work behind the scenes that, you know, I just show up and shoot. You know, this guy's, you know, between school and all this, you know, all the stuff he's got going on, and put out some really good videos, and you just see the quality of them has been a constant progression. And, you know, basically it came back. We're like, hey, we want to be your main sponsor. And it was like, really? You know, we were pretty much caught off guard. And, you know, it's definitely through John Noveski's his reputation in the industry that really opened the door to a lot of other people. You know, they're basically like, well, he vetted you, so okay, we'll give it a shot, you know.
I can imagine once you get that name on your roster, it's pretty much everyone else calls in play.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty much, you know.
That's what it was. I mean, when I spoke to Troy and Schmidt and Bender and Geisley Automatics, they said, oh, you're going to shoot for John? Sure, we'd love to help.
All right, we got Colonel Hertz back. This is his third strike if he strikes out on this one. Colonel Hertz, are you there?
He's there. He's
yes,
there.
I am.
Okay.
He's there.
You really want that T-shirt, don't you?
It appears to be some sort of a solar-induced atmospheric disturbance here with the phone.
All right, here on with Jansen and Rob. Ask him anything you want about 3-gun.
Question for you guys. I enjoy shooting my rifles, obviously, pistol and shotgun. And probably the only kind of practical shotgunning I do, and even that's a remote use of that term, would be something like sporting clays. In regard to three gun, could you just give me an idea of whether it's a more target and precision oriented sport or more of a practical sport? And what sort of targets do you guys shoot at? And maybe give me an idea of what a scenario or a stage would be like as far as you're moving and the way the targets are set up. You shoot around barricades, things like that that you see in other sorts of practical competitions. You want me to take this on?
I think the easiest, the quickest way for me to answer that would be to definitely take a look at some of those videos. I posted a couple of them in the thread discussion that's going on about this show. But the targets, as far as paper targets go, depending on the match, you can see standard USPSA targets, IDPA targets. At the match we shot back in Texas, we saw, I don't even know what those were called.
TSA, or they were their own version of those targets.
Yeah. And then as far as the precision, what kind of shooting, you'll see a little bit of everything. I mean, I don't know what precision shooting means to you, but at some matches, typically what you'll find is there'll be one quote long range stage, and the ranges, at least so far this year, haven't exceeded 440 yards. At the FN match, I think the longest target you had to shoot was 300 with a bonus target of 400, and you're usually shooting off a platform. Sometimes it's stable, sometimes it's not stable. They might have springs or coil springs under it. As far as your shotgun stuff, if you're shooting sporting clays or skeet, the targets are typically stationary clays or steel. Sometimes you'll have a piece of steel that when you shoot it drops down and flips a clay or two in the air. But typically, your shotgun stuff is usually immobile.
They're mostly static targets. There are some flippers, like you said. At the FN match, they had target throwers that were one of the stages we shot was very similar to a stage I up at my club. That there was I like shooting sporting clays every once in a while, and it kind of lets you, when you're asking about, what would be a good, way to break it down. If you do shoot sporting clays, obviously, different chokes. There's been a couple threads about, actual shot size or ammo selection to choke to change your pattern or your distance. To me, having a whole arsenal of different number sixes, high brass, low brass, number fours, I mean, to me, it's kind of redundant. I have a little pack of chokes, and I know I go to a patterning board. At 15 yards with an IC, I'm going to dust the clay. I know at a light mod at 25 yards, I'm going to dust the clay. I know at, with a full IM at 40 yards, I'm going to dust the clay. So, once you start knowing what choke selection, if we're shooting a lot of targets where maybe it's like a jungle walk or a jungle run where you got targets maybe point blank to 15, 30, 20 yards at most, you're going to get away with an IC or a light mod. If you got maybe a couple slug targets out to 30 or 40 yards, you might have some at the Blue Ridge Mountain match. We had steel gongs at 80 and 100 yards all over. You might be shooting pistol. You might be shooting birdshot here, and then there's a slug gong up in the trees, and then you got more birdshot and static steel and plates. And I tend to, we went to the High Plains shotgun match, which was an awesome match. It was an IPSC style match. We're going to be shooting a Pan American that's coming up at the end of July, and it's completely different than what normal shotgunning is. You're shooting buckshot on paper targets with no shoot hostage targets in front of it. So you got to know your patterns. You got to know what to expect. You're shooting at tight shots with pieces of steel. There might be two pieces of steel that are overlapping. One of them's painted white. That if it's a no shoot, if it drops, you're going to get penalties. And the target you need to hit is right behind it. So, I always go out there. I figured out my buckshot shoots better with my mod choke. I know where my slugs hit with my mod choke. I got comfortable shooting a modified choke. And you know, you shoot it like a rifle up and close, you know, the spread at 30 yards is going to give you a little bit bigger pattern. But you know, as for sporting clays, I mean, it helps out a lot. You know, you're shooting at moving targets, you kind of have a good idea of how to choke your gun appropriately. With a shotgun, it's just learning how to reload. I mean, really is what it comes down to is, you know, everyone, the shotgun, it's funny because, you know, they $3,000 pistol, $5,000 rifle. I mean, you don't go out and buy a $5,000 rifle, but when you start putting a short dot and an Oveski barrel and it starts to add up really fast. And to me, I can, you know, you kind of accept the cost that goes with it. You're going out, you spend a lot of money, you're traveling, you want the best equipment. We all kind of, you know, we know the situation. But it seems like people always skimp on the shotgun, and it doesn't make any sense because that's the only gun that's going to hurt you every time at every match. The shotgun has lost more matches for more people, you know, than you would believe. You get out there with a Remington 1100 that you don't got all the bugs worked out of it, or a Benelli, you don't have the right ammunition for it, or you get out there with a pump gun because, you know, pump guns work. I've seen pump guns go down left and right, you know, just operator error, equipment error, something breaks, you can't fix it. I mean, I have enough parts to fix 3 M1 Super 90s. I haven't had to do it, but, you know, as soon as I don't bring those parts, my gun's going to break. You know, I've been to big matches where I broke a part and it just happened to be the part I didn't have, so.
That's how it works. I don't mean to interrupt you, but we're really short on time. I wanted to get our last caller in really quick. Colonel Hertz, please IM me your shipping information. We'll get your stuff out to you. Echo 5 Kilos from South Carolina. Make it quick. We've only got a couple of minutes.
Hey, guys.
Hey, man.
Hey.
How you doing today?
Pretty good. I'm actually, you guys are in Georgia. I'm kind of near Savannah and shoot a lot of IDPA out there. There's no real 3-gun in the area. So if I was going to, you know, make the effort and drive several hours to a match, in the area, what would you guys recommend? Just one or two matches a year for 3-gun.
Well, you know, Fort Benning, that match is already probably sold out. There's probably a waiting list right now, and that's down in Columbus. We have quarterly matches out in up in Conyers, Georgia. It's the South River Gun Club. If you were to go to Georgia IPSC, IPSC.com, there's a kind of got a. They do them quarterly, so there's a print. You know, the guy updates it frequently with all of our pistol matches that are, you know, Georgia's got like 11 clubs, and if you wanted to get into pistol shooting or, you know, 3-gun's a little bit, you know, there's a little bit left to be desired. There's not a lot, too much stuff going on. That's why we pretty much travel out of the state to all the big matches. But, you know, that'll get you in the door and kind of see what's going on in your neighborhood or your neck of the woods. And, you know, definitely the South River match is probably, it's a state level match, you know, but it's a club price for a state level match. They do them quarterly. There might be one next month. Is it next month?
Yeah, I talked to one of the people that runs that match, and she told me that the big multi gun that they're going to hold at South River in November is the second week of November. And that's the tentative date. So, you know, keep your eye on that GeorgiaIPSC.com site, but. That's going to be a great match, and like I said, the word is second weekend of November. There's several guys we know that shoot up in South Carolina that come down for that match, so you wouldn't be alone. There'd be some other South Carolina guys there.
Yeah, okay, I mean, great. Check out Spartan.
You guys out there.
Yeah.
Spartanburg has, you know, they do stuff. I mean, there's just if you go online and look around, you know, that Georgia IPSC and, you know, some of the threads, Brian, you know, so there's a lot of threads. If you go in there to the multi-gun match schedule, you'll find something. And, you know, there's usually a lot of people asking questions, what's the round count? And you kind of get a taste of what to expect before you get out there. So there's, you know, with the proper channels, you can pretty much narrow down to what's worth going out to, you know, what's worth staying on for. So.
Hey, guys, right, we're cool. Completely out of time. Echo 5 Kilo, send me your shipping information. Oh, we'll get your package out to you.
All right, we'll
I have so many more questions for you guys. Maybe after the Pan American Championships, we can get you guys back on.
Yeah, definitely. That was fast.
Okay.
Just me yapping, but.
Jensen Jones and Rob Romero from the Noveski shooting team giving us a little look into 3-gun and the way it works. We'll get these guys on again because I have a bunch more questions. Thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate your time, and good luck in your upcoming competitions.
Hey,
thanks
for having a blast. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. I want to thank Joe DeBurgelis, as always, Micah Clark from Camp Patriot, Jack Rhodes from the Pony Express, Fairfowl308 for a great interview. Check out his website, fairfowl.blogspot.com. We're out of time today. I want to thank Seth, our super producer behind the scenes, stays quiet but keeps everything running smooth. Just want to say God bless the great Republic of the United States of America.
The chair is against the wall. The chair is against the wall. John has a long mustache. John has a long mustache.